So I wanted to start by finishing up the strong CP problem. By describing this parity solution, which to me looks like the second most, you know, again, the last time I described the possibility of the up quark, maybe, depending on who you ask, could still be that its Yukawa coupling could still be zero, and that maybe, or at least at some energy scale, it could have been zero, and that could be a solution of the strong CP problem, and that would be the most minimal and elegant possibility. But then I wanted to describe the what seems to me to be the next most elegant possibility, and I'll try to describe it rather quickly because just to give you the gist, to get across why it's nice, because then I want to try to fit in at the end of the lecture just a brief introduction to prion models, just to give you the flavor of that, because that seems like an interesting idea that never quite worked out, but maybe will work out in the future. The idea, first of all, let me just say that this parity solution is an old idea, but actually there was a very nice improvement of the idea just this past year in a paper by Lawrence Hall and Keisuke Harigaya, which I think is a really nice paper. So it's like archive, if you're interested to look at it, it's like archive 1803 .. So it's about a year ago. Basically the observation is that in a very minimal extension of the standard model, that you can have exact parity, which it remains exact. It's only broken spontaneously by the vacuum. And that gives a very elegant solution of the strong CP problem, very simple solution. And then also manages to explain a few other puzzles about the standard model at the same go. So it's kind of it's kind of a good example, if you want, of I think it's worth looking at this paper as a kind of good example of what I think of as good, how you can still a really good paper in beyond the standard model physics. You know, it doesn't solve everything, but it really has this flavor that, you know, like I was discussing in the first lecture, you know, there's a puzzle and we've made some progress, and then there's some pieces on the table and no one's quite figured out how to fit them together, but it's kind of playing around with those pieces and seeing, oh, you know, here, this seems like an elegant way to put them together, and some things get resolved. It feels like a bit of progress. I mean, I want to contrast that with what, if you want, most papers in beyond the standard model physics for the past several decades have been, which is that sometime as the 70s went into the 80s and 90s, people began to sort of lose confidence that they would be able to really get the puzzle pieces to elegantly fit, and a lot of research switched over. This is true and also early in cosmology, early universe cosmology. The research switched over to, you know, here's a model that I can think of that is you know, agrees with what we know at low scales, but is differs at high scales, and even though it maybe doesn't solve any puzzles about the low scale universe, it, you know, the motivation for studying it supposedly is that it at least isn't ruled out, and it could make some interesting predictions for future experiments. And, you know, basically, I just want to say that if you ever find yourself, you know, in a talk about that or being suggested to work on that, I mean, it's basically a waste of time. I mean, you know, it's like not, I mean, again, the goal is to solve this puzzle. And if you think about it in that term, it's not a good way to go about it. I mean, it's just not really, it produces publishable papers, but it's a very unlikely way to make progress on the puzzle. So, but anyway, it's a bit hard to say exactly what the difference is. So I mean, I kind of like to point to examples that seem good. And so I think this is a great example of a paper that's of a higher cut. So anyway, what's the idea? Well, first, so if we take our standard model and it has the first three lines and then the Yukawa terms, theta term we're trying to get rid of, we're trying to explain the non-observation of. So, you know, if we made the substitution here, if we changed d right goes to e to the I alpha d right, that's d right j goes to e to the I alpha d right j, just an overall phase rotation, and then we also made the corresponding phase rotation here, e to the I beta u right. Well, under that substitution, this matrix would pick up, you know, phases from the right, e to the I alphas. Every element would get multiplied by that, and so the determinant would change by e to the 3i alpha. And similarly here, okay, so the determinant of yu here, we could change its phase by e to the 3i beta. And on the other hand, you know, from the what we were saying before, since this is a chiral rotation, either of these is a chiral transformation of the fields where the anomaly, we're transforming the left and right-handed fields that talk to SU3 in different ways. In particular, we're not transforming Q left in either of these transformations. So some anomaly term will be generated by this. So it'll be some 3 alpha. So if we take this term theta 3, it'll get shifted by such a rotation, like theta 3 goes to theta 3 plus 3 alpha plus 3 beta. So what you can see is that if we now take instead this combined quantity, we take theta 3, so if we define theta 3 bar to be ordinary theta 3, the coefficient of the GG Twiddle term, and then minus the phase, the argument of the determinant of YU times YD, that thing is invariant under chiral rotations of the quarks. So for that reason, it's really this thing, you know, and the electric dipole moment of the neutron, that's a physical thing that shouldn't depend on your chiral rotation of the quark fields. And so it should, and it does end up being that the actual physically measurable thing, the electric dipole moment of the neutron, depends on this combined quantity instead. So what we'd really like to do to solve the strong CP problem is to kill both of these things. So the proposal for how to do that is as follows. So again, I I introduced the proposed model already last time. We're gonna take the absolute simplest left-right symmetric extension of the standard model you can think of. So SU3 is already left-right symmetric, but SU2 only acts on the left-hander, so we'll add corresponding SU2 right, and then a U1 here. And so now the fermions will be the same fermions as before, but we'll group them. We'll allow this symmetry to act on them. So Q left, just as before, is a triplet under SU3, a doublet under SU2. It doesn't act here, and it has some charge plus 1/6. Okay, it's ordinary charge. I called this B minus, let me give it its ordinary charge for a second. Last time I said this was B minus L, and I called this 1/3. I'm just gonna normalize that all down by 1/2, because it'll make the relation to the previous model clearer. The ordinary standard model clearer. Then I take U right and D right, and I combine them into a Q, into a quark right. So they're still a triplet under SU3, still a singlet under SU2 left, ordinary SU2, but now I've grouped them into a doublet under this new SU2. And they also have this same charge. And then the corresponding leptons, L left and L right, singlet under SU3. This one's a doublet, as before, and a singlet under the other under SU2 right. This one's the opposite. And this one, just like it used to have U1 charge minus 1/2, it still does, and now this one does too. And then there's the scalar fields. I'll take the old Higgs and call that H left. So it has, it's a singlet under SU3. Just as before, it's a doublet under SU2. It's a singlet under the new SU2. And it has some charge 1/2, as before. And then now, following the same pattern, H right, H, corresponding field H right is the same thing, but as usual, we just swap these two columns. Okay, so those are the fields. Very little extra beyond the ordinary standard model. We just have these new gauge fields, and we also have this new mirror partner of the Higgs field. And now, just like we wrote down the most general Lagrangian for the standard model, we're just going to write down the idea is to write down the most general Lagrangian for this model that's invariant under this gauge group and Lorentz invariant. But now we're just going to add the one additional condition that if we take any left-handed field of T and X and swap it with its corresponding right-handed field of T and minus X, that the Lagrangian is invariant under those. If we do that simultaneously to all the fields. So we take every left-handed, everything with a sub-left here, we exchange it with its corresponding right-handed field, because parity changes left to right, chirality, and then parity also takes X to minus X. Okay, so we just do a parity transformation on everything, swapping the leptons with the leptons, quarks with quarks, Higgs with Higgs, okay? What does that model look like? So I first want to explain that this model has no strong CP problem. We'll kind of write down all of the. Let's look at what the Yukawa couplings would be for this model. Well, if you think about it, actually, you can't write down any dimension 4 Yukawa couplings for this model. There is no term you can write down involving two spinner fields and a scalar field that is gauge invariant. Uh, okay, I'll leave that as a little exercise to check, but it's very, you know, you did the exercise where you wrote, you figured out what you could write down for the standard model in terms of Yukawa couplings. If you just do the same thing here, you'll see it just can't make it match up. You can't make the Lorentz indices and the gauge indices all go away for the term with two fermions and a scalar. So what you can write down are dimension 5 terms. So in this model, so just like in the standard model, you couldn't write down any mass term for the neutrino at dimension 4, up to dimension 4, but instead the neutrino mass appeared as a dimension 5 operator. Well, in this model, all the masses appear as dimension 5 operators. And so then, they're simple. They look very, now again, you can do the exercise of what dimension 5 operators are there, and what you see is at dimension 5, there are analogs of all of the usual Yukawas that you would have met in the new SM. The standard model, when we added a right-handed neutrino to the standard model and wrote down all of the Yukawa couplings for that model, well, there were basically 4 different Yukawa couplings involving the Higgs, and then there was one explicit mass term we could write down of Majorana type just involving the right-handed neutrino. And so the situation here is analogous. So again, I leave it as an exercise to check this, but so if you just ask, you know, what are all the gauge invariant combinations I can write down at dimension 5? So it looks like this. There's a term that's like 1 over some mass scale, which I'll call M sub D, of, okay, well I can, to soak up the spinner indices and SU3 indices, I can write down something like this, Q left talks to Q right. Q left bar times Q right. Okay, this has a family index and a family index, which I contract again through some 3x3 dimensionless matrix YD. Okay, and so then I just have to get rid of the, so I've taken care of the SU3 charge, and I've actually taken care also of the U1 charge here. So I just have to get rid of the SU2 charges. And so there's two ways to do that, okay? There's this, the down type term, which we're writing down, is where you contract this with an H, you contract this Q left's SU2 index with an H left SU2 index over here, and you contract this Q right's SU2 index with an H right dagger over here. Okay, so that's term one. And then there's an analogous term. There's the up type term, which is where you write down the same term, but now instead of H left and H right, we have H left twiddle and H right twiddle. Okay, you can check that that's another thing that works. So H right twiddle dagger and H left. And then for the leptons, you can write down analogous terms involving the leptons. There's an ME term, which involves the left-handed lepton doublet coupling to the right-handed lepton doublet through a Yukawa with a Yukawa matrix contracting their family indices. And then again, times contracted with, this guy contracted with H left, this guy contracted with H right dagger. So that's the analog, lepton analog of that term, and then we have the lepton analog of that term, M nu, a neutrino type term, H right twiddle dagger, L left bar Y nu, L right, H L twiddle. Okay, those are the terms that involve a coupling between the left and rights. And then if you ask yourself, oh, can I write down anything that couples left with just left with left or right with right? And it turns out, well, with the quarks, no, but with the leptons, you can. So there's a term that's like 1 over M sub M. And then let me write this way. I'll write it. So recall that back when we were writing down the neutrino mass term, we use this, the dimension 5 mass term for the neutrino in the standard model effective field theory. I use this trick that I defined a new fermion, psi left, which was the left-handed lepton doublet, but then contracted with H twiddle dagger. Okay. Back then that was the ordinary Higgs, but now I'm calling it, now my new name for the ordinary Higgs, but Higgs doublet, remember, is H left. So let me define psi left that way. And again, the point about this thing is that now this is a left-handed spinner, where if you think about it, the SU2 index here has gotten soaked up by the SU2 index here, and the U1 charge here has gotten soaked up by the U1 charge here. So this is gauge invariant, left-handed spinner. So I can write down a Majorana-Fermion term for it, a Majorana-mass term. So I can write down a term that's like, if I define its charge conjugate, I remind you that its charge conjugate, the charge conjugate of any fermion is defined to be I times gamma 2 times that fermion complex conjugated. So if I can write down a term that's like that. And then I can write down an analogous term for the right-handed guys. Crucially, I have to add the Hermitian conjugate here, and I also have to add the Hermitian conjugate of all these terms here. Okay, so those are all the dimension 5 terms you can write down in this theory. Again, I leave it as an exercise, but it's now that you've done this analogous thing for the standard model, this is going to be a piece of cake. Now, the point is that if you just check that if you insert so now the picture is we have these two Higgs fields, but it turns out that just demanding that the theory has exact invariance under this symmetry, under this left-right parity, that will impose some constraints on the Lagrangian that we will see in a moment, but what it will not do is force the VEV of the left-handed Higgs to be the same as the VEV of the right-handed Higgs. They can, in general, they won't have the same VEVs. Parity symmetry does not enforce that. And so in particular, it can be that the VEV of the right-handed guy, the new Higgs, in other words, is bigger than the VEV of the left-handed guy. And so in this model, one assumes that the VEV of the right-handed guy is a lot bigger than the VEV of the left-handed guy. So parity is very strongly spontaneously violated. So in that case, we can imagine coming down in energies from very high scales. At very high energy scales, the theory has unbroken symmetry. But then as we come down in energy, we cross some threshold, which is the VEV of the right-handed field. And below that energy, everything that gets a big mass when the right-handed field gets a VEV, we integrate that out. And every time that right-handed Higgs appears in the Lagrangian, we can just replace it by its VEV in the effective theory below that scale. So below that scale, we have a new theory that just involves the old left-handed fields, the left-handed Higgs. So we want to see that recovers the standard model. And so you can do, there's two simple exercises you can do. So remember, in the standard model, we did this calculation where we saw that when H, the general Higgs field, if we replace it by this form, V plus, we wrote it as a VEV plus a Higgs boson. In this form, this theory is spontaneously broken. And we looked at the generators that left the generators of all the different SU2 times U1 generators in the standard model, which ones left this VEV invariant? Those were the unbroken generators, and we saw that there was just one, which was what we would ordinarily call electric charge, okay, which was a combination of the third SU2 generator and the hypercharge generator. Well, exactly analogous calculation here, if you let h right break to 1 over root 2 0 v right plus h right, so v right is the VEV of the right-handed Higgs doublet, and h right is the corresponding Higgs boson, corresponding right-handed Higgs boson, you can show that what that does, if you look at the generators that leave that thing that previously acted on it, and then which linear combinations of those generators leave this VEV invariant. And what you find is that the SU2 right our new symmetry group again of the full theory is SU3 times SU2 left times SU2 right times U1 B minus L. I say B minus L because again, if you multiply all of these charges by 2, these charges are just proportional to the baryon minus lepton number. The baryon number of a quark is 1/3. The lepton number of a lepton is 1, so baryon minus lepton number is minus 1. So, so this is just up to convention. This is U1B minus L. What you find is that when you put this VEV in, first of all, that this part of the group breaks down in exactly analogous fashion to how in the standard model SU2 times U1Y broke down to U1Q. Here, SU2 times U1B minus L breaks down to U1Y, where now this is the hypercharge that's the unbroken part. So now we're left with exactly the usual standard model gauge group under this breaking. And secondly, if you just take the VEV part of this expression and you plug it in to all of these terms, you'll see you recover exactly the Yukawa and mass terms of the new SSM, of the new SM. So in other words, the standard model including a right-handed neutrino, the terms that we wrote down before. So from here you just recover the 4 Yukawa couplings to the ordinary Higgs and then the Majorana mass terms, the Majorana mass term for the right-handed neutrinos. I'm sorry, so this theory recovers neatly the standard model, but with this important difference that if you ask what symmetry is imposed, so first let's impose that parity symmetry. So we get all the same terms as in the standard model, but the parity symmetry will give a little bit more constraint on what those terms can be. In particular, you'll find, if you just apply that parity, if you demand that this Lagrangian is invariant under that, you'll see that it forces these 4 matrices, yd, yu, ye, and ynu. So parity forces y, d, y, u, y, e, and y nu to be Hermitian. Okay. So now as we already discussed in the previous lecture, parity sets the bare theta 3 to 0. Now we're saying it also forces these Y matrices to be Hermitian, but a Hermitian matrix has real eigenvalues. The determinant is the product of those real eigenvalues. So the determinant is real, these matrices. So if you look at our expression for theta 3 bar there, theta 3 is killed by parity because the GG dual term violates parity, as we argued last time. But then that second term, arg of determinant of u minus yu times yd, is also killed because now parity requires yu and yd to both be Hermitian matrices. Okay, so that's why the strong CP problem is solved here. Well, that's kind of neat. That's a rather elegant solution, I would say. And then, but then they go further. They point out two other nice things which happen in this theory. So first of all, let's talk about the RG flow.
Yeah. So if parity is now preserved in the standard model, shouldn't we also get rid of the B tilde term?
Indeed. Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's a good point. Yeah. So in this model, indeed, that B twiddle term would be killed. You're right. Mm-hmm.
It has had observational effects.
B twiddle? No, B twiddle has not been observed to have any observational effects. Oh, you mean because I was saying that in topological insulators it does?
Yeah, sure.
Well, so that I think is there's the fundamental parameter, and then there's the effective parameter in a condensed matter system. So what's observed in the lab is not evidence that the fundamental parameter appearing in the Lagrangian is non-zero. What it's saying is that in vacuum, the corresponding theta for electromagnetism in vacuum is zero. That's the term appearing in the, and that's the theta appearing in the Lagrangian, if you want. But inside a topological insulator, inside some certain blocks of matter, it acts as if theta is pi, but it's not that the parameter in the Lagrangian. There's no observational evidence that the parameter in front of theta, in front of the BB twiddle term in the Lagrangian, is non-zero.
Okay. Yeah.
And indeed, it would be zero in this theory. Yeah.
Do the neutrinos in this model have to be Majorana?
Yes, they do.
Yes. Couldn't be Dirac.
What?
Okay.
Well, actually, let me say no. So I'm sorry. So it's like what you really get back is the what you really get back once you imagine you give H right a big VeV, and then you go below that scale, you integrate out everything, and you just look at the standard model fields that are left below that scale. Then it looks just like this theory. Okay, so this theory has two. The masses for the neutrinos come from two places in this theory. They come from this term. Okay, this term gives a coupling between new left and new right. And then they come from these terms, which give a coupling between new right and new right. It depends. So it could be that for some other reason that this matrix is exactly zero. It's allowed by symmetry, but who knows? Surprises happen. We've seen that already. Maybe some other reason we don't know rules out this term. In that case, this term alone would predict that the neutrinos have a Dirac mass. Alternatively, it could be the other way around. It could be the case. But as long as this thing is non-zero, then you get three heavier guys with Majorana masses and three lighter guys with Majorana masses.
Second question: have there been any observations that mean that parity is violated in the real world?
In the real world, parity is violated. Yes. So. The standard model appears to maximally violate parity in the sense that only the left chiral pieces of every fermion feel the weak force, and only the right and the right chiral pieces do not. So in the real world, it's badly violated. But in this model, the idea is that at high scale, in the real theory, it's in the Lagrangian, it is an honest to God exact symmetry, but it's spontaneously broken. So it's analogous to SU2 times U1 invariance in the standard model. That's not a symmetry. That symmetry is broken by the vacuum, but it's exact in symmetry of the Lagrangian. Okay, yeah, so just to say, while we're talking, let's break time. Okay, I have a joke. What is green and has two doors? A sports olive.
What, sorry?
A sports olive. And a sports olive. Okay. The idea is that a two-door car is sometimes called a sports car. But this one is green. Okay.
Nathan, I have a question. It's
yes.
Not my original question. So even if it's horrible, I don't take credit for it. So for the particle physicists working on the strong force, when they eat a salad, what
is this going to be a great joke? Because you should save it for tomorrow. Because it's because then I, okay, yeah, go. No, go ahead. If the spirit has moved you, go now.
So for these strong force particle theorists, what kind of principles do they use when they pick their salad?
No,
lattice gauge theory.
That's really good. I mean, that's almost as good as my joke going. Okay. Wow. Suddenly, we're getting to the end of the class, and it's all bubbling out. We're going to have extra lectures just to let everyone get their jokes off their chest. You know, do it now, because there's only one lecture left. Okay. I'll really save it for tomorrow. We're going to need one then. Okay, so let me just quickly finish the story of what's nice about this model. So they point out two other things. So the first is that if you look at the RG, if you look at the running of the coupling of the gauge coupling constants, again, we had this problem that in the standard model, in the standard model by itself, the gauge couplings don't unify correctly, so they don't seem to agree with grand unification in that sense. At least they don't unify directly. You can add super partners to make the standard model supersymmetric, and then if you imagine those super partners are down at the electroweak scale, you fix this problem and the gauge couplings beautifully unify, but too bad. We don't seem to see super partners down at the electroweak scale. And in any case, that seemed like a lot of extra baggage. There, that was, adding super partners was, it was supposed to solve this hierarchy problem between the electroweak scale and the gut scale or the Planck scale, but it never gave an explanation for why there was a big hierarchy. It never really explained the problem. It was only supposed to be stabilizing this. If for some reason this one was tuned to a much smaller scale than this, it was supposed to stabilize that small scale against quantum corrections. But it wasn't really solving the problem one wanted it to solve, and at the same time it was giving a model that had a lot more particles and free parameters than the standard model. And then now we don't observe those particles. It's very likely that that is not the right solution. So the question is, well, what else can we do to make grand unification work? So in this model, something else happens. So we can think, well, this model can be neatly embedded in SO10. And so then what happens is that if we plot the gauge couplings as a function of scale, I defined the fine structure constant, GI squared over 4 pi, and then I plotted that thing to the minus 1, because that was the thing that ran linearly with log lambda, with the log of the energy scale. And so we had alpha, we had the coupling constant for G1 and G2 and G3, and so in the standard model, these begin going up like this with some coefficients that we calculated on the board and calculated in the tutorial. So that's on 41 over 10 for B1. So yeah, just to remind you, they had some renormalization group running DGI D log lambda is equal to, let me not screw this up, BI times GI cubed over 16 pi squared. And then the constants, this was some dimensionless constant that depended on the gauge coupling and what fermions and bosons talked to that gauge field. So for the standard model, B1 was 41 over 10, and B2 was minus 19 over 6, I think, and B3 was minus 7. Okay, and so those give the slopes of these lines, or minus those coefficients give the slopes of these lines below. So again, the structure of this theory is that H right gets a big VEV, V right. So that VEV happens somewhere here, okay, V right. So for lambda below that scale, the theory looks like the standard model. So the running is just the same running as in the standard model. Now, in the standard model, if we continued these things, they wouldn't meet. They kind of, there's a big triangle formed by them instead of meeting at a point. But then above this scale, well, now the theory, at energies above this scale, the theory looks like the SU3 times SU2 times U. It looks like the 3-2-2-1 model. The field content is this full field content. And so we can calculate anew that doing the exact analog of this calculation, we would get new coefficients here. Okay, so, well, actually it turns out that so in the original theory we were calling our gauge couplings G1, G2, and G3. Now, in the higher theory, the SU3 times SU2 times SU2 times U1 theory, the U1 in the higher theory is, again, B minus L. G2 and G3 are really the same as before. Really, there's now a G2 left and a G2 right, but the parity symmetry demands those are equal. And so those are really both the same as this G2, and the G3 is the same in the two models. And if you calculate now what the corresponding beta function coefficients are here, well, the B3 is unchanged, B2 is unchanged, but GB minus L is changed. Okay, so BB minus L turns out to be plus 9/2. So it's bigger than this. 45/10, in other words. So the slope, okay, and then it's a little exercise to check that previously we talked about how this coupling constant, the G1 that we use to ordinarily describe the standard model, differs from this one by a factor of √3/5. So that this one is the right normalization for grain unification. There's a similar argument you can give for this guy. It has to be normal. This is the G that is appropriately normalized again for grain unification. And you can show that at the matching point, so at this matching point, there's a rule connecting these two guys. Again, this is a little exercise. That G1 squared at the matching point is equal to 2/5 times 1/GB-L² plus 3/5 1/G2². And so we run G2 and G3, we run G1. We use that equation to convert G1 into GB minus L. There's a little jag here. and then its slope changes. What we find is that if we put this thing, put this break in the right place, then suddenly they do unify. Okay, so they all unify at a point, and it turns out that these guys show, it's a little exercise you can do just using these equations. Quick exercise is to show that they now unify at, if the VEV here, if the scale at which the standard model switches over to this more complete theory is about 10 to the 10 GeV. Okay, so that's the first thing. But then the nice thing about that is that, another nice thing about that, I should say, is that they point out that, so at the high, you know, above this, at this scale and above, the Z2 symmetry is manifest. So if we look at the full potential that we can write down for H left and H right, it looks like, so there's a mass term, which can be, which goes like H left dagger, H left plus H right dagger, H right. Again, this is, I'm just going to write down the most general potential that I can think of that's parity symmetric. Then there's another term, which is like H left dagger H left plus H right dagger H right all squared. So there's the quartic term like that. And then there's one other type of term you can write down. You can write down a term that has H left dagger H left times H right dagger H right. Okay, but now, at this moment, H right gets a VEV, and so it gets a very big VEV, this 10 to the 10 GeV VEV, relative to the electroweak scale. So down at the electroweak scale, at scales, once we get below this scale, the effective potential is the one where we just replace HR, and just imagine we take HR and replace it in this expression by its VEV, whatever, one, VR. Well, under the assumption that the VEV of the right-handed VEV is much bigger than the left-handed VEV, well, you can find what's the minimum of this potential. The minimum of this potential, well, since H right, since the VEV of H right is so much bigger, you can just ignore the H left terms, and you can find from this potential that the VEV of H right is I guess what I meant to say is H right squared. H right squared is M squared over lambda. And so then if you just plug in, if you want the effective potential below this scale, you just replace H right by this very big VEV, plug that in everywhere and look at the remaining effective potential for H left. And what you find is that it's lambda prime times the absolute value, I mean times the VEV of H right squared times H left dagger H left. So that's the mass term in the standard model. And then there's lambda prime times 1 plus lambda prime over 2 lambda times HL dagger HL squared. So in other words, this thing has to be equal to the quadratic coupling of the usual Higgs in the standard model Lagrangian. And so in particular, this VEV is measured to be of order 100 GeV, whereas this thing is 10 to the 10 GeV. So lambda prime has to be tiny. But then from here, now this thing is the quartic coupling lambda in the standard model. This is the quartic coupling of the ordinary Higgs boson. If lambda is lambda prime is tiny, it's saying that lambda in the standard model is predicted to be zero at this point. Well, I was showing a plot the other day that lambda in the standard model, after we measured the Higgs mass, lambda in the standard model, it's non-zero at low scales, but if you look at the renormalization group running, the best fit currently is actually that it goes to zero at 10 to the 10 GeV and then climbs back up. And the other day I was saying there's some uncertainty in the top quark mass, so at the upper end it's possible that it can just barely go tangent to zero, but the best fit is that it goes negative at this energy scale. And so this seems to give an explanation for that as well. So yeah, it's an elegant thought. So I for my money, this is the second most elegant explanation of the strong CP problem that I am aware of, and a nice example of beyond the standard model physics, the way that I think it's, I like this. I think this is a nice style of thinking.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So this effective potential is valid anywhere below the BEM of the...
Yes, that's right. There's something, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So would it, I mean, how do you, like, so why can you identify that it's zero at the point of V-right?
That's a very good question. So, there's two ways to think about it, okay? There is the potential, the way we've described it so far is that there's a effective action that's valid as a function of scale, and as you vary the scale lambda, the cutoff and the path integral, the coefficients in the Lagrangian flow. And in particular, the coefficients in the potential term for the Higgs will flow. And so from that standpoint, the idea is that, well, up here, this was the last point. Above this point, the Z2 symmetry the potential has Z2 symmetry, now when it's spontaneously broken, and we replace the H right by its VEV, we have this prediction that at this point, the quartic self-coupling of the Higgs is zero. But then now below this point, we're working with the effective potential for the Higgs left by itself. And now, since that theory no longer has this parity symmetry, we find that its RG flow will not respect that requirement that parity sets this coefficient to zero. Instead, it will find that it'll flow just like it flows in the ordinary standard model. Once we run it down to small scales, it'll still be small but non-zero. There's another way to say it, which is really, it's ultimately equivalent, but another way to say it is that there's another notion of what the effective potential is, which is scale independent. So there is this so-called effective action. I mean, let's say what we've been describing so far is the Wilsonian effective action, okay? But there is another thing which confusingly is also called the effective action, although it is related to this, which is where you do a Legendre transform of the actual action to get this other thing called the effective action. And then that thing, the potential there, in the potential part of the effective action is called the effective potential. And what it depends on, it really looks, you can think of it as being like, it has a quadratic and a quartic term, but then the coefficients here are the are the running coefficients at a scale given by h. So as h moves, so as you take the value, so as you take the value of h out to 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4, 10 to the 5 GeV, lambda actually isn't a constant. It's a field dependent constant. In other words, really, it's not a constant. There's more field dependence here in lambda, and that field dependence is exactly given by the RG flow of the coupling constant lambda. It turns out that if you really want to ask, you know, where does the VEV of this field sit, it turns out it's this effective potential, the potential that appears in the Legendre transform of the ordinary action, whose minimum really determines what the VEV of those scalar field is. And, okay, that second part, I shouldn't have even said that I'm sure it confused things more than clarified. Okay, let's see, so... Oh, my poor prion models. I feel I may have to cut them. Okay, too bad, can't cover everything. Let's call it a day there.